This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
My deep gratitude for Michael, Doug, and Cliff is not here now to invite me over. My name is Shoho. I live in Santa Cruz. I have been living here before, and I'm always grateful for coming back. And if you don't hear me because I have a soft voice, please raise your arm anytime. Okay, can you try to come forward in any way?
There's one right here, too.
There's one right here. Okay. But continue to raise your arm if you don't understand what I said. So welcome. Who is new to Jikoji? Okay, and to meditation at all? Most people didn't. Yeah, most people have sat meditation before. Yeah, so one or two. Okay. Why don't we go around and say our names?
My name is Todd.
Todd.
Jen.
Jen.
Mark.
Mark.
Hogan.
Corinne.
Corinne.
Dawn.
Kisia.
Nico.
Nico.
Rolando.
Rolando.
Lily.
Lily.
Karn.
Karn.
Ben.
We go back to over here. We missed some of you.
You'll see.
I'm with the three.
Miami.
Mommy.
Mommy. Back here we were.
Alan.
Harris.
Sinani.
Me. Hey, my name is Lisa. Pam.
Sriram.
Arushi.
Sriram.
Benjamin.
Katie. Elizabeth.
Doug.
Mike.
Sure. Not sure if some of you on your Sunday excursion made it or have made it to the Hakone Gardens down on the way to Saratoga. Yeah, some of you. Right now it's winter and you can really see the beauty of the landscape idea that people did there. And it's kind of like Japanese culture, so I'm relating it to the experience here. And what seems to penetrate and be similar to what Zen is, in the Hakone Garden you see a master stone and a worshipping stone. Do we have a master stone in Jikoji? Maybe. No.
They're all in relationship though.
They sure are, aren't they? Yeah.
And this place is founded on no hierarchy.
On no hierarchy?
So there is no master student stone.
Okay. Then keep talking while I'm talking so we can clarify all these things.
Could you repeat what you said, please?
This Jikoji temple was founded, and Koban gave one of the precepts he gave for those who are here is there is no hierarchy in this organization. It's an impossible precept to keep, but it is also one to consider, because when the water is off or out, the plumber is king.
And maybe indirectly, I just went to the beautiful memorial stone. So for you, if you haven't been here, if you come out the sendo and you go the pathway to the right to a bridge, and there's a little bridge, and you make a little turn to the right again, there is a beautiful stone with an encouragement of the founder's name. And maybe that is a master stone after all. So master, a worshipping stone or a relational stone that out of around which everything is circulating. I'm bringing it up because in some of you, you know, having done meditation, just, you know, having done it or are exploring it right now, there seems always to be the question of what am I supposed to do? You know, our mind is an open space. And I would love to hear your experience. But particularly in the beginning, we are trying to focus on something, and that's our master stone. So to speak, if you take up the practice of counting breath, that would be, you know, your concentration, you try to concentrate on it. And once one is settled, over time, one lets that go and just rests in open spaciousness, and then, you know, that awareness is your reference point. And yet there's a beautiful story of Chao Chang saying the Dharma body, the master stone, emanates a lot of awareness bodies, just like the moon reflected in water. And that is the wisdom body. So the wisdom body is the ultimate master stone in Buddhism, so to speak. So we have stages in meditation where we concentrate on and that we go in relationship to. And they're all based on our vision, our effort to get to know our mind. So I'm speaking from experience when I say when I first sat down to meditate, there were just so much thoughts. Suddenly it seemed like it's like uncontrollably this mind cursing and windy and thinking and planning and hoping and fearing. Yeah? Anybody of you notice some of that? Yes, okay. Yeah. And there was just a session here, right? So session is one of these beautiful opportunities where one just exposes oneself to this wind, and then that's these winds settle over time as we not turn away from them. We just keep looking, and they calm down, and there's more of a spaciousness. And that becomes like a new focus for us. We're becoming more and more aware of the space that holds all these things that come and go like this. A little bit more of an ease. A little bit more of a space. Like we still might be caught up in our plans and our hopes, but there's a little more space around it. So that's another stage of our meditation. And then the ultimate Dharma body is the wisdom. When the wisdom arises in the midst of the space, that helps us to know ourself, to know this space, to know all appearances in this space. And so, talking about relationality in this story that I was just trying to relate to you, his master Chao Chang said, this Dharma body, this wisdom body, emanates awareness bodies, you know, space, thoughts, just like the moon reflects in water. And that image of moon reflecting water, you see that right now with all the puddles. It doesn't have to be a moon, but it can just be the sky or the leaves. So there's this reflection. And then the story keeps going where the master was saying, so how do you understand it? And the student said, I understand it. It's just like the pulley looking into the well. So if you have a well, and there's like a structure atop it that has a pulley, and the pulley has a bucket. And then one drops the bucket in the well in order to fetch water. Yeah. Something that Chikuchi might have too. So there's this pulley reflects in this, you know, well, so it's just directly on top, just like the moon. It's just like another image for the moon and the water, or the pulley in the water. The pulley is just a nice image because it wants to get the water. There's like a yearning, like the master stone and the worshipping stone. There's a yearning. And it's just so human, I found, you know, we have this very human longing. I mean, if animals could talk, we might ask them if they have longing. If the animals have longing too, they might. But right now I would say it's very human because I hear a lot of stories of longing. So the worshipping and the master, that's kind of this, you know, we are just Valentine's Day. It celebrates that same dynamic of longing, of, you know, there's two and we long to be one. The worshipper longs to be one. So that dynamic between the master and the worshipper. So that's what the student said. It's just like this, you know, longing towards the water, the pulley reflected in the water, looking at the water. And then the master said, well, it's a half of the story. And the student said, well, what's the other half? And the master said, well, it's a well looking at the pulley. So it's a both-way relationship. And I always get goosebumps with this story because like recently I was in a retreat and the whole retreat was reading on instruction from my teacher on wisdom. And there was this final talk, and I was like, oh, the final talk, it's gonna really push me over the edge, it's gonna like give me the main wisdom instructions. And then the last main wisdom instruction of this final 2 months retreat was the teacher telling me in this recording of how much he longs to be with his students. And I feel like there's something about that longing to know it's actually not ending that gives us some rest. There is some rest there or some peace there. You know, we always think we have to fulfill longing. But ultimately to know that even the wisdom body is still looking and longing and yearning in its own way. So the story, I repeat it, it's a master saying, the Dharma body, the wisdom body, emanates awareness bodies, just like the moon reflected in water. How do you understand? And the student said, oh, it's just like a pulley looking into the well. And the master said, oh, you got 50%. And the student said, what do you say? And the master says, it's like the well looking at the pulley. So, I said a lot here, and I would love to hear from you. What do you, if you hear about longing, if you hear about that relationship between wisdom and awareness, between wisdom and your life right here, right now, what's coming up for you? What questions, stories, relationality? Yeah. Hi.
Well, the first thing I thought about is Martin Buber. I think I have the right person. He's a Christian or Catholic theologian, and he wrote about the I and thou.
That
dialectical relationship, which for anyone that doesn't know, I can't really explain it very well, but basically he's referring to God and us, or a person, but in kind of a mystical, abstract way, more similar, I think, to what this story is relating. And, you know, obviously that resonates a lot with me, coming from a Christian background.
Okay.
The idea of feeling like there's something big out there, you know, that, like, I'm a part of, but that I have, can kind of have a two-figured, two-sided dialectical relation with.
Yeah.
And I think that the issue that comes up when I try to reconcile that with, you know, non-dualistic teachings, whether specifically Buddhist or just kind of Eckhart Tolle style, you know, there's no, you know, even non-duality is a form of duality, it's a form of an assertion, you know,
mm.
like, no, those things are not two. It's like there is no not two. But I guess what I'm saying is that I think that it really gets at these really interesting questions of, like, to what extent is there a self?
Mm-hmm.
Or in what sense is there a self?
Mm-hmm.
And in what sense is there an other?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, when we say there is no self, like, what does that really mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, because the apparent level is also real, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you could say, like, oh, Kecia, you perceive you have a self, but you don't.
Mm-hmm.
But that's an assertion that may or may not... If I was just to go off my direct experience, I would say that, like, well, it seems like I do, and that's... I'd have to take your word for it, you know? But anyway, that's a really, really big question for me, is, like, to what extent can we use kind of, like, that relational model
mm-hmm.
To understand things? Because I think there is something in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of like the idea of, like, personal love.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of, like, is there really any value to having a specific person or, like, a special relationship? Is
mm-hmm.
that really any different from my relationship with you or that
right.
table,
right.
for that
yeah.
matter? You know, it strips away a lot of that to have, like, the conventional interpretation, at least, of the non-dualistic, no self, no other, no master stone, no, you know.
Well, all these teachings are coming in response. I mean, it's easy because we're so smart. In our culture, we really got, most of us got really good education, and we learned a lot, and we get to read a lot. And we forget that this body that we, of teachings that we can explore right now, that's out there in books, and that we can, you know, like read out of curiosity, that they're actually, particularly in Buddhism, but also I think it's true for other religions, they were set forth in order to remedy. They were like medicine. They're like handed out for different diseases of our mind and our heart. Particularly the wanting to come to a conclusion about what's real. Sometimes some of us are way too immature to, like, be there, because you know, as much as we try intellectually to have a conclusion that we can come to rest with and say, oh, it is like this or it is like that, because that kind of helps us give us a direction. I think it's important to be able to leave it as that. It's a direction. Like, non-duality, for most of us, it's a sign on the road, you know. It's a sign on the road that says, you know, if you go that road, there might be relief of suffering down that road. I think that's important to remember, but it doesn't mean just because we heard the sign and saw the sign, we know what it really means. And that's why many teachings, particularly in Buddhism, I found most fascinating is that, like, there is no qualm asserting something for the longest until the student is ready to fully understand it. For example, atoms. There's whole schools that assert atoms. There's partless particles. That's what this world is all based on. And until one finally embraces it, and then the moment you fully embrace it and you have a full experience, not just like an intellectual understanding, but an experience, a whole body experience, at that moment the teacher comes and says, there are no atoms, you know, mm-hmm. atoms are not real, and here is the method. But if one is not there yet, then the method doesn't have the potency and the power, because, you know, then because it didn't matter to us first that there are atoms, and it won't matter to us if there are no atoms, you know, kind of like...
Yeah.
Because we have to embrace it. And that's kind of daring, because starting to embrace something, you're letting go of other things. And to be able to let go of our identity, of who we think we are, of how we think this world works, is already, there's a lot of grief part of it. I think there's a lot of, like, most of us, for example, are still like having another foot in science, you know, like we love science, it makes sense to us, it's experiential and so forth, and a lot of mystical things you can't prove to anybody, you know, they're just your own experience. And so we dabble with it, with science all the way along, and it makes sense. Many things are parallel and it's beautiful. But at one point we have to say, what is really real? And then it's really words. Then we really are with words. And then we have to admit that words are not the full story, you know? Like, words are words, but our experience is different, and that's where it can be scary sometimes. Yeah.
I have a comment on PCS questions about self thing, and I also have a question regarding the master stone thing you talked about. But first, my comment, this question used to puzzle me as well a lot regarding having no self, or the idea of no self. And I read this book by William James. It's called The Principle of Psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And he's considered the father of modern psychology, and that book is kind of like started the school of psychology. And there's this chapter in it titled Consciousness of a Self.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about how we develop this consciousness of a self, and at the bottom of it, he says the self is this warm, fuzzy feeling of us, right? Or we are there. And at the bottom of it is this, it's this memory of this warm, fuzzy feeling that we have been having since childhood,
mm-hmm.
of being there and watching,
mm-hmm.
and feeling,
mm-hmm.
and having this sense continue.
Mm-hmm.
For years and years, and on top of this, on the memory of this and continued memory of this, we build this idea of self, of us having all of these experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And so he quotes other authors saying that like this consciousness of a self is repeating persistent ideas of us. And the proof that in other chapters this book provides is that it is seen that people have two selves. You know, it's two self is a real thing, and there's examples of people who consider themselves, let's say, Mary,
mm-hmm.
but then if you whisper something in the ear, the hand will write down something, and this phenomena is called automatic writing.
Mm-hmm.
because there's a Sue also living in the head,
mm-hmm.
and she has her own sense of self. So I guess this no self is a real thing, and it reminds me of the sutra, the Heart Sutra, where it says Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when practicing deeply the Prajna Paramita, perceive that the all five skandhas are empty.
Mm-hmm.
And these five skandhas are our senses and how we attach ourselves to the experience of these senses and develop a sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
I guess Vasubandhu also talks about it in his when he says that there's the sense of self comes over this, he talks about three things I'm forgetting, but how he talks about how this sense of self comes about and what are its afflictions and the rest. So I just wanted to share that. And I had a question about what you talked about regarding the master stone and the moon being reflected on the water and how it relates to wisdom. So I didn't quite get that.
Mm-hmm.
It was though refreshing to hear Doug talk about Jikoji being founded on no hierarchy, which is it's a disruptive idea and extremely refreshing. And I guess that makes Jikoji so unique. But if you could talk more about the master stone and moon reflecting on,
mm-hmm.
on the lake and how it relates to wisdom, I didn't
quite
get that.
Right. To your first question, I didn't quite hear a question, but I did hear your marvel about the fact that there is our mind can can grow and form itself. And psychology has many ways of describing it. You're reciting a psychologist. And I think there's a lot to share, and I hope and I'm glad that our culture is talking about the mind more, something that we in this particular culture haven't done that much. Nobody grows up looking at their mind much. So we're learning about the mind, we're learning about the different features of how the mind can experience itself and its relationship. And Buddhism has a lot to share about it. And I would not try to make sense of it too early, because I was trying to say earlier, these teachings are laid out for particular understandings. Like the person who understands two minds, and the person who has no mind idea, there's different things to be said to each of those. So just take all of this as, you know, you heard it, and keep listening. And as of the Master Stone, though the Master Stone in all these differences is, I'm using it as a directive, a relationality. And maybe all of that relates to what you were saying. You know, I had recently the sense of, like, when we are born, we have the sense of unity coming out of a womb, and then realizing being alone and realizing, you know, going off, realizing ourselves being different from others. But in the meanwhile, we get nurtured through one food first. You know, most of us, I hope, had the fortune to get the mother's milk, which is, you know, one big portion of nurturing substance, some substance that's, like, really strong, really good for us. And at one point, we get more and more different foods. And I'm saying this because differences can be very confusing, and it's very soothing to have one, to have a sense of oneness for us. Like, oneness is very, being close to somebody, feeling intimate with somebody else, having something that's, you know, so nourishing. You know, like, I had talked with recently somebody who told me about his entire search of looking for this elixir that's, you know, sustains life, and one thing he found, some elements of it in mother's milk, you know. So it's kind of not surprising that we give each other what we need, you know, in the most intimate way. And so I had this image of us having this journey of an infant coming out of this oneness experience, coming out of this fully being nurtured through the mother milk into differences. And in this middle of differences, we have to find ourselves. Who am I? What am I? What is my life's purpose and all of that? And by the end of this life, we have to wrap it up. We have to come up to some conclusion. You know, death is asking all of us by the end of this life, what was this all about for you? Where were you in the middle of differences? You know, what did this all mean to you? There's a sense of, you know, we came out of this one womb and we are merging again. And I don't know what your understanding of death is, but we are merging again with something, you know. The journey goes on. And is this one, the sense of oneness, that sense of unity and love, that connection, that relationality, that intimacy, were we able to live it and understand it? Were we able to find the shelter, find the protection, and also give it to others, you know? Does it make sense to you?
I didn't quite follow.
Yeah, good. Thanks for saying that.
let me rephrase the question. So you talked about the fact that our minds are this constant storm and wind blowing, and when we sit, let's say, in Sashin, we face it directly,
mm-hmm.
and then it seems like our thoughts and hopes and worries and plan making kind of settle down, and there is the storm is turns into a breeze, and that we have all experienced it happening, at least those who meditate. or even if those don't, they find it somewhere else playing music or whatever. Like my question was, you talked about as we meditate, there's this wisdom that arises, and you compared it to a reflection of moon on water, and it had to do something with the master stone. I don't know, it just, the idea seems stuck in my head.
Okay.
And I just want to understand what you mean by that inner wisdom arising,
mm-hmm.
and the reflection of the moon on water, because this metaphor of reflection of moon on water is, I've read it in other places as well, and I'm just curious what that relationship is.
Okay. The relationship relates to the three bodies of Buddha. So the wisdom body is the Dhammakaya. Some of you might heard these three bodies. So there's a Dhammakaya, which is a formless body, the wisdom body. And that's basically another description for awakening itself. Then there's Sambhogakaya, which is a light body. That's our awareness, the luminosity of our mind. And then there's the Nimanakaya, which is a manifestation body. And a manifestation body is our perception, what's perceivable. The Nimanakaya is that which is perceivable. So the Dhammakaya nobody can, it's formless, right? So it's not, you can't talk about it and you can't perceive it. However, the relation that's closest to the Dhammakaya is this light body, which is luminosity. It's clear light, bright light. And in fact, we can't make sense of anything without light. We need light. light is the light of our mind, right? The light of our awareness, the light of our perception. Though there's always some light that's necessary for us to, you know, enter a relationality or even define ourselves, you know. And the Sambhogakaya is also not something you directly see. Like you can directly see the Sambhogakaya, but only meditators who have been gone down the path for a very long time have been able to see the Sambhogakaya directly. And the Nirmanakaya is actually also hard to come by, but it's maybe more often there. So I said it's in the realm of perception, Nirmanakaya, but it's pure perception. It's a perception that's free of judgments, free of impurities. It's a pure perception. It's a perception that already has some form of love and wisdom in it. So Shakyamuni Buddha was said to be a Nirmanakaya Buddha. And he had realized wisdom and love, compassion. So these three bodies. And this story about the Master Stone was a story about the relationality of us being, you know, these worshippers, these ones who are yearning for that which is carrying us, which has emanated us, that we are in relation to. In Buddhism, we don't have so much as in other religions, where God and the worshipper are like separate. Like in Buddhism, actually, there is like, we don't say there's separation. But to say we are all just one makes it kind of hard to understand why there's so much difference going on. Does this make more sense now? I don't want to focus on you. Anybody can actually say. I think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I came here, I used to be here at Jakunji.
Okay.
I love the surroundings here. And when I came in, I hear the wind blowing. I hear the creek was pretty loud. And then I'm going, you know, if we take it down to the simplicity of our existence here as creatures, and we take all those that live, the, you know, the creatures that are here besides us human beings. The surroundings talk to us.
Mm.
You know, the trees waved at me, and the creek was singing their song. And I come here and I sit and I totally enjoy the silence. And then I go, this is so simple. Mm. This is so simple. And yet, during the meditation, you know, my encasement tells me all about the things I have to do and all the things I worry about. And,
mm.
and then I go back to listen to the brook, to the creek and to the wind talking to me, how simple it is. And I think that we, as creatures, we're probably the only creatures in the world that just our higher intelligence brings us to kind of have a lot of the duality and trying to figure out where, you know, what is and what isn't, what's self and what's not self, what's selfless. And yet, all the creatures, you know, that's non-human, they seem to just take that, you know, their meditation is like right there,
mm.
right? Just like right there. They just see what's out there and they just enjoy it. They live at that experience
mm-hmm.
at that moment. No, they don't. I don't see how they can just find a perceive things. It's just what's there.
Mm-hmm.
You experience life to the fullest. Life, what's there right now, the beauty, or the pain, or the trauma, or whatever, and just kind of like right there, no questions asked. If I mean, even now, you know. When you look at Marie Kondo with her little minimalistic thing and how to fold clothes and all that stuff, I go, why don't we just take that and just say, why don't we fold our own selves into a nice, neat thing and then just be able to say, this is it, we're done. And just live like that and say, I'm organized, I'm sitting where I'm sitting and I'm neat and tidy as can be, and yet nothing chaotic. Yeah, but I think we just make it chaotic, you know? And, but if you think about it, we make that space,
right,
you know,
right.
Empty it out, sort of like, so that way we have room to hear what's out there, you know, that the universe is trying to tell us, instead of getting cluttered, and we just enjoy that sacred space that we have at this very moment,
mm-hmm.
and just say, oh, that's the message, that's what I need to do. I need to enjoy life's experience. I don't see that we have to have a meaning to everything, but I just see that what did you bring to this existence? It brings you joy.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's what it is, joy and happiness. And to just live life to the fullest and just not have any limitations that you can't you can do or this is all that you can do.
I feel like I have...
Keep it simple.
I feel like I have a deja vu experience of where I was recently, somebody was like, oh, I'm so open to Buddhism, and I talked with him about Buddhism. And then at one point he was like, well, what does this have to do with anything? And then I realized, you know, you need suffering. If you don't suffer, Buddhism is not for you. If you don't have a question about like a sense of like I'm in pain, things don't work out the way, you know, I'm trying my best, things just don't work out, you know, like, and I'm afraid of my death. Like I'm getting a sense that I'm really gonna die and my full life's gonna end, you know. If there's not that sense of like, this sucks. It's not for you. Then, you know, you better really just go to the gardens and enjoy them to the fullest, but you won't get anything out of it. Like enjoying life fullest is good. It's what we meant to be. Nobody's going to take you away, you know, from living life to the fullest. But then you also don't need to sit for hours in the sendo, you know, because that's just work then, you know. Like it's actually work to sit there for hours and have a sense of what's going on and chaos and confusion and keep looking at it. Um, renunciation is the first step for the past. The founder, Shakyamuni Buddha, did that. He had the full life, and he saw the four signs of sickness, death, and old age. In particular, old age, I feel like, is one that this country that's so into the usefulness of everything, entrepreneur, new projects and anything, is maybe underestimating of how painful it's going to be for us if suddenly our, you know, limbs start hurting, our sides start swaining, and we don't feel function anymore. Like, there's a sense of our functions loosens us. It's very painful to feel like you can't participate anymore. And then the question of, like, what's the purpose of my life? The old age is a big store of suffering that all of us are sliding into day by day. And so Buddha, having seen these three signs, and from that was so terrified, was so touched by them, said he was like, I gotta do something about it, and saw this renunciant who was like, you know, I'm living the good life, you know, meaning I'm really looking through what's going on here, and I'm not disturbed by it anymore. I was, but I'm not anymore. So that's kind of the founding moment of this religion or this movement here.
I'm not quite sure whether or not I was misunderstood when I said live life to your fullest. It doesn't mean you party hardy and
no, I understand.
Stuff.
Yeah,
I wasn't sure because you said something. I feel like you took it down to where you said that's Buddha's life is, you know, you have to have pain and suffering. I wasn't sure because that isn't exactly what I meant when I said live life to your fullest. I didn't say skip the pain and suffering because that is part. I'm just saying that life gives you, if you have pain, take a lesson from that. Take a, you know, learn from that, you know, the pain, because pain tells you you're alive, you know, and whatever else around that comes, that process you through, that puts you through a life's path journey, as to there's everything, a message coming in, you know, from the higher, you know, from a higher consciousness, from above. And that is pretty much how, you know, Buddha's teachings are, is that in itself, you know, it's you know, he did that. He took and learned something, and then that's where he was trying to teach others with through wisdom in different ways on,
right.
on what it is. So
right.
I wasn't saying live life to the fullest, party hardy and do this, you know, that's not what I meant. I'm just saying, you know, like, we're here, enjoy it.
Right.
And if there is something that's challenging us, then take that challenge and you know, look at it and find out how to make a better person out of yourself, because that is what the lesson is. And then you have experience what's out there.
I think I understand what you're saying. Mm-hmm. I heard you say that there is a certain life experience that we can just really receive our life, accept our life, and also work with it. You're underlining the life affirming qualities, and I think that's important.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really trying to make a point that without that yearning for something really large, without that yearning of breaking free from this life. And I think Buddhism gets misunderstood because it's like, why do I have to believe in suffering when I'm Buddhist? Why do I have to, you know, believe that there's pain and look at the pain when I'm Buddhist? You know, like, it seems so negative, right? But I feel like, and I was trying to say in many ways, is that these people from who have handed down the teachings to us to this day, they have seen something that we cannot imagine. The Master Stone has a vision that we don't know yet. And that's why those who are worshipping it they're fascinated by it. They want to be like that. And that fascination has to grow so strong that we're ready to give up anything else, that we're ready to let go and forget everything else that we're familiar with. It's that strong of a yearning that you come out of your meditation and you're a new person. Each time you sit down, you're like so determined by, the, you know, I'm going to give myself so strong and longingly to that which makes me, which has carried me, which is a wisdom body of my true being. I give myself so strongly to it that by the end of the session, I will be a new person. I will be different. I let myself be changed in my meditation. I let myself be changed in my practice. It's kind of a surrender, a giving yourself so fully and with so much yearning that in itself has so much power that it's transformative. And that doesn't mean we have to deny life or, you know, be not say yes to it and not live it fully. I think, in fact, it has to do with a full life. But it has to be a sense of, I'm also ready to let it go. And I think because we are leaning on the side of not being ready to let it go, because we have, you know, we put a lot of effort into being who we are. We put a lot of effort into, you know, having a full bank account, having loving relationship, having, you know, a car, having all these things take effort. And it takes a lot of time to have these things. So to be like, I'm going to make a real budget household check-in about where I'm putting all my energies, and I'm ready to unplug all these other things and put them into this master awareness, insight, promise of really waking up, of waking up. You had a question? Two questions?
I was musing when you were talking about the yearning, and it was around how did that yearning manifest?
Mm-hmm.
And last night I was reading in Chogyam Trungpa's book about the quality of luminosity,
mm-hmm.
and he equates it with clarity. And so then when you talked about the Dharmakaya and Sambhogakaya, I thought that if luminosity is clarity and this yearning is flows both ways, that the myriad things was perhaps a yearning for clarity, manifesting, but the yearning goes both ways, with all the myriad things.
Mm.
So there's kind of a magnetic pull.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's not just yearning one way, it's you can't help yearning.
Right.
And it's planned that way.
Right. Yes. And when it happens, you know it. Like in the Zen tradition, do you guys, I don't want to put you on the spot, but there is the word Kanon Doko. It's a kind of mystical union. Do you know another translation for that? Kind of mystical union. That's kind of hold for that. And mostly it's between your teacher and the student, because it just really helps to have a person who is like you, who speaks like you and talks like you, and you can, you know, communicate, that it's helpful to have that kind of a relationship so you can confirm, for confirmation's sake. But you can also have that union, of course, with trees and landscape and moments, and that true being of ours is not separate from us ever. So we can have that magnetic pull, that awakened, you know, meeting with our true nature, with that master stone, with the Dharmakaya, it can happen to us. But it's a gift. We can't make it, we can't create it, it's a gift. But our yearning is part of it. That was my hope for you to really take home with you, that whatever you're yearning for right now in your life, if you can see where does it go, is there a yearning for you to be free, and can you use that card of wanting to be free from your suffering, from the fear of death, from your insecurities? Can you use that yearning to be free and direct it towards a one-pointedness of liberation that's called bodhicitta, the mind of awakening, that just, you know, I want to reach liberation really badly. can all your yearning can come into that focus, and through that focus, let your life be transformed, let your life be consumed like a fire, like have that spark, like really burn down your life or burn up your life in a transformative way. And that's the invitation. And I think that's the invitation for us every day, every sitting period, every moment. And I heard the bell, so maybe we can take this conversation to lunch. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jikoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.